sponsored program are strictly those of its participants and are not necessarily those of WWPR Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
It's time for the Morning Edge here on WWPR 1490 AM. Heard Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 9 AM to 10 AM. I'm Henry Raines. Here's Augie.
Morning, Henry. Good morning, Tampa Bay. Well, we have all kinds of things happening. We have Egypt in some kind of turmoil between the Arab states, the administration working backwards, the siding with the military by the Arabs, essentially, and the Russians are now setting up meetings with Saudis and with the, they're just setting up a position. They're going to send in their own troops into Egypt to take our place. They're looking for a way to further embarrass this administration and the way it's handled the whole thing.
Well, listeners from last week, remember when we informed them well before they probably heard it anywhere else, that Prince Bandar Bush, is for people that can remember Fahrenheit 9/11 from Michael Moore, had gone to Moscow to speak with Vladimir Putin and, of course, the related staff and ministers, etc. And he had offered to make huge multi-billion-dollar arms purchases for Egypt and from the Russians, and also to refrain from competing in the natural gas market for Europe. That part was rebuffed by Vladimir Putin, not motivational enough for the Prime Minister of Russia. But what now it turns out that he has in his sight is a whole realignment of the Middle East allies and adversaries, which is really amazing because he's on the opposite side of the Saudis in Syria. And now he's offering to come in as support for the Egyptian military, even to the point of offering to do joint military exercises after President Obama decided to cancel the joint military exercises.
Yeah. Well, I think it's all about we are just as important as the United States, says Mr. Putin. We are the people we always were. We are the Soviet, only much smaller in number. I think this thing with Putin is very, very interesting, and he, I think, has gone on a full bent thing to embarrass this administration, and I suspect, along with the treatment of the gays in Russia, the general racism that runs through that country, and with the support of the Russian Orthodox Church and the inherent culture, and with the desire to bring back the importance of Russia, all these motivations concentrate in ways that Putin will be a troublemaker of an immense sort. That's the way.
Well, I don't want to say troublemaker because he's acting in his interest like every leader of a country usually does, either in his interest or the nation's interest that he leads.
Well, troublemaker.
And is it?
Yeah, but troublemaker in that he is willing to cast aside any kind of relationship with his major adversary, which is us. I guess he sees us adversarial, and however important he is, he's not just a petty troublemaker. He's a serious one in that he's unwilling to compromise anything. The matter of shutting down the adoptions and so forth, the willingness to imprison his enemies, and to further snub us and to shove it in our face, the making of, at least temporarily, of Snowden a citizen of their country to protect him. I mean, he just had a series of things that are really...
Well, why not?
Why not? And from his position, you're right.
Well, look, we're putting anti-ballistic missile batteries right on his border. We're moving up into the old Warsaw Pact countries.
Yep.
Which would is more important to us? Holding on to Edward Snowden and keeping him out from getting arrested, or maybe putting anti-ballistic missile batteries at the Mexican and Canadian borders? Which is more aggressive?
Well, obviously the latter, but, you know, this is the way of things, and we've provoked an awful lot, is what you're saying, and I don't disagree with that. I think that is the provocations. Do they warrant what he's doing? You can argue all day long who's right or who's wrong, but the provocations are there nonetheless.
And I go back even from that. It's not provocations one way or the other. It's acting in your interest. And he is acting in his interest, putting a counterbalance in the Middle East. It is now, if he's seeing an opportunity.
Which is what I said earlier.
It's not as vital to us as it was in the Carter years when he declared that the Persian Gulf was a vital interest. We're moving to energy independence faster than anyone expected. And we have the biggest military power. So we can lay back in our interest and let him fiddle. And there'll be the people like the Lindsey Grahams and the John McCains that'll say the sky is falling.
Yep.
But when it comes down to it, it's an interesting play in the drama there. But really, the Saudis aren't ready to break with us yet. Egypt isn't ready to break with us yet. 20 years from now, you could say, well, maybe. But then 20 years from now, the Russian Federation is going to have a demographic time bomb in that they're... population is decreasing, and their Islamic population
is increasing.
Yeah,
and they are going from 150 million to about 110 within by 2020. It's not that far away. So, yeah, you're right. They are in trouble, and the adoption thing was all about the demographics, and we got to keep our people here, even if they have no homes, if we provide nothing for them. For these children that are in orphanages. So this the symbolism of that goes to the very things you just said.
The biggest paradox is we have a total reversal. Well, we shouldn't say total reversal because this what we're saying about Russia and Egypt and Saudi Arabia
is
just
hat,
play.
The white hat.
It hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
But we actually have an alliance in Syria with Turkey and with Egypt and the United Arab Emirates and Qatar and Jordan, and we have a whole group of disparate players on the southern side, and then we have another group of players on the northern side that seems to have, we have Chechnyans from Al-Qaeda Chechnyans combating Syrian troops there that have been sponsored by Saudi Arabia, and now we've got talk of a no-fly zone to be implemented for all those people that say Obama isn't doing anything. This comes from an Israeli news source.
General Martin Dempsey, chairman of the U.S. Chiefs of Staff, is in Israel this week before going on to Jordan. He is checking the preparedness of the U.S. forces and the Israeli and Jordanian armies for their roles in the Syrian war under a master plan projected by President Barack Obama. Obama's final decision on U.S. military intervention in the coming 2 to 3 weeks will depend on Dempsey's recommendations. On August 2nd, Devco Weekly revealed that the U.S. plan hinged on a no-fly zone and a buffer strip. The no-fly zone over southern Syria and Damascus would be enforced by U.S., British, French, Turkish, and Saudi Air Force jets. The buffer zone in the south up to Damascus would be captured by 3,000 rebels trained in special operations tactics and armed by U.S. forces in Jordan. Jordanian special forces are to spearhead the operation under U.S. command. U.S. boots will be barred from touching Syrian soil. Dara, fountainhead of the Syrian uprising, will be proclaimed the capital of liberated Syria. Bashar Assad is not marked for ousting, only for pushing into a corner. This week, his forces embarked on blocking tactics by destroying southern rebel strongholds ahead of the intake from Jordan. Solidly behind him are Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, Vladimir Putin, and Hezbollah's Hassan Nasrallah. Assad may take the fight outside his borders by launching missiles against Israel, Jordan, and maybe Turkey. Hezbollah may join in with rocket attacks on Israel. Iran will beef up its active military presence in Syria. Russian rapid intervention units are on standby for saving Assad at their Black Sea and South Caucasian bases. The Russian Mediterranean war fleet is also at hand off Syria, Lebanese, and Israeli shores, and Russian teams have arrived in Syria to man the S-300 anti-air systems for preempting no-fly zones. The Syrian war may thus bring the U.S. and Russia to the brink of their first major confrontation since the 1973 Yom Kippur War.
Well, I mean, that is extraordinary, and that's, I think...
And where else do you hear it except right here in Tampa Bay on the Morning Edge?
And Al Jazeera, I suppose.
No, well, this wasn't on Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera isn't going to talk about this anymore. Al Jazeera is in the pocket of the Qataris.
Well, I was speculating.
Oh, no, well, I'm answering. Okay. I'm answering the speculation. You got to turn into tune into the Morning Edge.
There you go.
Because it's the only news... and talk show that is going to go. I've got stuff from Euro News that we'll probably never get to here. I've got stuff from Russia Today that I hope we get to, because the disaster in Fukushima could turn into a huge, huge disaster that would affect us here in the United States. It's on the verge of happening. Maybe we'll get to it after our guest coming up in a few minutes.
Definitely go there, absolutely. And our auto industry is in the gun sights there.
But just the alignment there of those powers in the south of Syria, all the European powers plus Saudi Arabia, but then on the north, as we said, the Turkish forces, and then these Al-Qaeda forces that were brought in by Saudi Arabia and the Qataris, the Chechens, a whole like foreign legion of Al-Qaeda forces there. It's like, well, you can see just Syria being carved up, problem solved, a bunch of little Balkanized states that the major powers can just do what they will with.
Well, the Al-Qaeda are the unknown, and actually Hezbollah is a perfect co-respondent should that develop, and maybe is already in place for all we know.
And Vladimir Putin does a finesse here that I doubt will succeed, but it's worth the play. You know, I'm not a bridge player, but I've heard of finesse in bridge, and this certainly sounds like something to get
definitely.
The other players on their heels, because...
Yep.
Suppose Egypt decided, I don't think the calculations come out that they would, but Egypt goes, well, maybe we're okay with that. And then Saudi tips, and then Jordan tips the other way, and all of a sudden the Europeans, who are the real ones at risk here, not so much the U.S., find themselves out in the cold.
Russia is playing a card game here, and or a chess game perhaps is a better word for it, because they definitely are positioning themselves. I mean, with the three theories of Mr. Joshua Staker are that the Muslim Brotherhood will be encouraged to pursue increasingly extreme measures to fight the army, and with the expectation of international applause, the generals will be encouraged to escalate their steps for repressing the Brotherhood, clash. Saudis and the Gulf Emirates will double or redouble their support for the Egyptian general Sisi and his campaign against the Brotherhood. This will widen the rift between the Arab rulers and the Obama administration.
Well,
we should tell
while you're reading this person. He's going to be on the air here in just a minute.
Right.
Joshua Stacker is the assistant professor of political science at Kent State. He's the author of Adaptable Autocrats, Regime Power in Egypt and Syria. Obviously, Augie is loaded for bear for this guest. So rather than keep him waiting...
We might as well bring him on.
Yes, I've got a little bit of background we can play while he is coming in on the phone line, and we will... this is a couple days old from Euro News. I think the death toll is up to about 800 now.
It was 800, yeah.
It could be much higher.
Maybe more. They're imprisoning people, and the theory is they're being killed in the imprisonment.
And Egyptian police are getting killed, too. We'll throw those headlines at Joshua Stacker in a second, too.
Off the bridge.
But what this particular report does, it speaks to that, Augie. Of course, we see what the military is doing. We have plenty of video of that. It's talked about on our media. It's talked about on the world media. But the Muslim Brotherhood has their resources, too, and they managed to pull off a few things over the weekend, too. The Friday rallies did not come off, probably because a lot of people that perhaps were not as strident in the Muslim Brotherhood said, well, I don't really want to get killed this Friday. I got other plans for Saturday. So we'll listen to this.
They don't want to go to heaven that quickly.
Pardon me?
They don't want to achieve heaven and the virgins that quickly. But, yeah.
They're in the midst of reading a novel or something.
Yeah, I'm waiting for Sisi to really come out and declare where he is. That's a general. But 941-745-1390.
Well, we've got our guest coming in.
But we've got a guest coming
in. But you can call and ask him questions on that number.
Absolutely.
Right after this.
any attacks on them or public buildings. Simmering tensions have already boiled over in Giza to the south of Cairo near the pyramids, where hundreds of Mursi supporters stormed the provincial government headquarters and set it alight. An eyewitness told Euronews the attackers were determined and well-armed. I was standing at the entrance to the governor's building. They all gathered there, and more of them came, trying to break down the gates of the building. There were some who had petrol bombs and automatic weapons and pistols. Egyptian state television reported near the scene of the fire, two police officers were killed in an armed attack on a police checkpoint. Our correspondent says the Muslim Brotherhood and their supporters are responding, moving closer to violence and attacks against government buildings, looking to destroy them, while at the same time the Egyptian security forces are stepping up their efforts to capture the people involved in these acts of violence.
Mohammed Sheikh Ibrahim, Euronews. Al-Qahira.
And that, of course, was a brief excerpt from Euronews about some of the action in Egypt over the week. And, Augie, we have our guest on the line. Joshua Stacker is assistant professor at Kent State University, Department of Political Science, where he teaches research in Middle East politics and hereditary secession Islamist movements, including Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood. Can't be more timely than that. His book, Adaptable Autocrats, Regime Power in Egypt and Syria, compares institutions and co-optation to explain authoritarian adaption. He also serves on the editorial committee of Middle East Research and Information Project. That website is merip.org. Of course, we will give you that website again and link to it on the podcast site. And Professor Joshua Stacker, thank you for joining us on The Morning Edge today.
Morning, Doctor.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Yes, well, I know Augie here has been looking over your work extensively. He couldn't stop talking about it before you got on the air, so I had to get you on the air as quickly as possible. Augie, go ahead, please.
Well, you really are, I think you go to the key, the business of what's happening in Egypt and why, I mean, the reference to al-Sisi as the pharaoh. What is that about? I mean, I think the public needs to understand and the authoritarianism that ties to the need for a large male figure.
Well, I mean, I think that basically what happens is that General Abdel Fattah Sisi, who is the head of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, is essentially just the CEO or the latest leader of the Egyptian Armed Forces. And the Egyptian Armed Forces feel themselves entitled or privileged or want to protect their privileges, both politically and economically. So they are the ones that are creating this sort of cult of personality that somehow equates the country with collapsing if al-Sisi is not there to hold it up, you know, in some sort of almost atlas-like form. But the reality of the situation is there's millions of people in Egypt that do not believe this. They came out on the streets in 2011 demanding more democracy, better economic opportunities, and more social justice. And after almost 3 years, they've been given none of these things by the Muslim Brotherhood nor the Egyptian Armed Forces.
Doesn't that lead to the point, and it's been said, that the people, when it gets right down to it, don't want democracy, they want control, and they want someone showing that control as an individual, and perhaps that's why Morsi acted as he did.
No, I mean, I don't know. You know, the real problem with the Egyptian Revolution is that, you know, there were lots of people that came out and wanted the expansion of political participation, the expansion of political representation, and there was a political elite, namely the military, that, you know, designed a transition that would exclude these people from actually having a say. The Muslim Brotherhood, ironically, is structured in much the same way. It was always about them, you know, controlling the system rather than expanding representation. So while there, you know, there's lots of authoritarian strands that go beyond the military and the Muslim Brotherhood, I mean, pretty much all the civilian political elites and a lot of the economic elites don't really think that a bunch of poor people should have you know, the right to participate. But this idea that somehow Egyptians don't believe in democracy, don't understand democracy, I think is an injustice to actually what they are about.
So you, excuse me, one follow-on. So you're contending that democracy in the real sense that even gender equality is involved. I know Egypt and Cairo particularly have been westernized to a large extent where women are concerned. So that is underneath all of this as well or not?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are millions and millions of Egyptians that believe in equality. Egyptian women work. Egyptian women raise families. Egyptian men work. Egyptian men raise families. It is a patriarchal system, but, I mean, aspiring for equality and having real equality in a true sense, that's just not practical in any country on the planet.
Right.
There's no country where women enjoy the exact same rights as men.
We're speaking with Joshua Stacker. He is the author of Adaptable Autocrats, Regime Power in Egypt and Syria, and he is the assistant professor at Kent State University's Department of Political Science, teaches Middle and East politics as well as other topics there. Professor Stacker, there's a report out this morning that in Cairo report that former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak will be released this week from prison where he was incarcerated after he was ousted in the Arab Spring of 2011. His lawyer says that he was cleared of charges of corruption and should be out in 48 hours. What do you make of this report? Do you put much stock in it?
No, I don't. I mean, he still has the charge that, you know, he was involved in killing protesters. You know, that was his lawyer speaking, so, I mean, I think we have to take that with a grain of salt. You know, my understanding is that the people that were in the court, the judges are actually thinking of ways to kind of make sure that he stays in prison while the other charges are sorted out. So, as with these things, always the way that the media runs with them in Egypt and these sorts of things is the trial balloons to see kind of what kind of reaction, where are we at in terms of crowd management? Is this going to produce a sort of millions of people in the streets, or are people kind of focused on other things right now? So, you know, I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Is the Russian move by Putin, what's the effect in that whole situation from your perspective? I mean, they're seeming wanting to, while having influence, to embarrass the U.S. And, of course, with Bandar not wanting to respond to go to Washington, where he went to Moscow to meet with Putin, these different contradictory, embarrassing moments for the U.S. are... illustrate something of a international conflict that we are party to. So where do you see this going?
And also comment, please, on President Putin's report that he's offered to conduct military exercises.
Yes, exactly.
With the Egyptian military.
I don't think that we should have any illusion. There is a strand right now in the Egyptian press that is like calling for an Egyptian Putin. And basically, I think that strand is actually coming out of the military realm, and they're using their sort of lackeys in the press to get this message out. And, you know, basically what the military would love to have is some sort of election where, a military intelligence officer rises to the office of the presidency, which is not all that inconceivable given the events. But the idea that the Egyptian military is going to somehow break with the United States military, of which they've had in a relationship for the last 35, 40 years, irregardless of what political elites in Washington are saying or what political elites in Moscow are trying to do, is a little bit hilarious to me. And my understanding is that when Morsi actually raised the issue with the generals a couple months ago when he was president that maybe we could consider Russia for other funding, that the generals just laughed at him. So I don't think this is a serious move. But there is a sort of counter-revolutionary wave going on in the Middle East, coming out of Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait. Russia, of course, is being very opportunistic, as any country should be, and they're looking to prey on this. And if they see that the sort of edifice of American power in the region is starting to wobble, you can expect they're going to pounce on it. It's not like the U.S. and Russia haven't been locking horns in Syria for the last 2 years.
Yeah, Doc, this situation reminds me of pre- Iran when we imposed the Shah, and that they were playing us off. They wouldn't side with Russia. They wouldn't side with the Soviet rather, and they wouldn't side with the U.S. over the oil issues. And that, of course, induced the Dulles brothers to do the terrible things that they did to cause the mess that we had and still to this day inherit. So is that the kind of bargain that they're playing with? Because if the aid is cut off, the 1.7 or whatever it is, $1 billion, everybody's speculating that that's going to be a hammer and you can't pound the nail but one time. And where's that going?
Well, one, I think that many of the legacies that we see now in the Middle East are a function or a product of the Iranian Revolution of 1979, where the Americans before that had basically put their entire stock in the repressive Shah of Iran's regime. And so when it fell and Iran slipped to being against U.S. hegemony, the United States constructed an elaborate security a securitization of the region all through the Persian Gulf, around the Suez Canal, and there were many aspects of it about being able to deploy for wars, about being able to protect Israel's security, and, that edifice, which some have called stability, is proving not to be all that stable. And now it looks like this could all come crashing down if they're not careful. In terms of the aid and U.S. aid, it's a little bit tricky. One, if you do not separate the Egyptian generals from their American general colleagues, if you do not separate that relationship, that informal relationship, then basically I believe the Egyptian American relationship, military relationship, can endure. The $1.3 billion in military aid which we give them every year annually, that really is a subsidy to the American defense companies. That money never reaches Cairo. It sits in a bank in New York City. And then the generals use that money to purchase American hardware and American weaponry. Incidentally, the American government, somewhere along the lines over the years, basically gave the Egyptian military what was tantamount to a credit card, which they have racked up another $3 billion on aid. And so if they cut the aid, you're going to have defense contractors that are very upset that they're losing that subsidy to their bottom line. You're going to have basically somebody in the government with a $3 billion, someone's going to have to pick up that cost. And so I just don't know. There's a domestic political economy to the aid. That even if it would be cut, I don't know that it changes the relationship that much. So the United States doesn't have any influence to dictate or, produce outcomes in Egypt. But at the same time, they're along for the ride and they're going to side with the power that's able to sort of, control the state. And right now that looks like it's the armed forces or military intelligence.
We're speaking with Joshua Stacker. He is assistant professor at Kent State University Department of Political Science. He is the author of Adaptable Autocrats, Regime Power in Egypt and Syria. You can find some of his works at the Middle East Research and Information Project, that is MERIP.org, just the acronym for the Middle East Research Information Project. You will also link to a number of his articles from the Kent State website. And Professor Stacker, if you could just help us sort of sort through our scorecard, because a year ago it seemed like that part of the main President Obama's administration's foreign policy was the cultivation of the different threads of the Muslim Brotherhood throughout the Arab world as though that they could be worked with and perhaps developed as assets. And then when we look at where Syria is today and where Egypt is today, we see an opposition between the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood and the Saudi ruling family. And when we look at Syria, we see this cooperation on the southern side with Jordan and some of the European powers, and inclusive of Saudi Arabian elements. But then there's reports on the northern front of Syria that Qatar and primarily Saudi Arabia have brought in other groups of fighters, in particular Al-Qaeda fighters from Chechnya and the Caucasus were reported to have captured the Syrian air base in Manak. How do all these players align with the different larger powers?
Well, you know, it goes back to that old, trope about politics makes strange bedfellows. So, you know, for instance, you know, you have Saudi Arabia, which is probably the most religious or the most overtly religious political establishment in the world, even though, the rulers of Saudi Arabia aren't very religious. And you know, they are fundamentally financing and backing the military to crush the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. While on the other hand, they're willing to kind of fund Islamists to sort of get their aims done in other countries, right? So really, and this really goes back to, you know, it links back up to, you know, something we could link to the United States. So there's this debate that goes on about the United States about how political Islam is fundamentally, you know, at odds with what America is trying to do in the region and what America's about, value-wise, and this, that, and the other thing. And so, you know, in the case of the Taliban, that's absolutely true. In the case of Iran and the Islamic Republic, absolutely true. In the case of Saudi Arabia, not so much. So what it really is about is it's not about political Islam, so, you know, as an indicator of who's funding what, as much as is, do they see this group, which happens to be political Islamist or not, furthering their cause? And so that's where you're seeing all the money being spent in wild directions and often very contradictory ways. So, you know, money really follows interest in ways that ideology doesn't.
Have we found sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that goes back to the Bush administration about a global jihadist movement, and in that not so much the ideological impulse is funding it or propelling it, but that players like Saudi Arabia have developed these expeditionary forces, these cat's paws, if you will, from places like Chechnya or from Libya or something where they can become global players without putting their military out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Saudi Arabia has expanded its influence. I mean, but, you know, again, I mean, Saudi Arabia may be the closest Arab ally of all of them to the United States. So, I mean, it's a very kind of contradictory position. And you know, I mean, Saudi Arabia has laid its fingerprints in places like Bosnia after the Balkan Wars in the 1990s. And so, you know, there's this game, this sort of great game that's going back on. And everybody's kind of rolling with the punches, and I suspect that's why we see such, you know, wild policies and people, you know, going country to country.
Saudi seems to be very, very crucial to this whole thing, and with the money situation, but with the energy needs dwindling or seemingly in peril from their standpoint, from our use and the Western use, I mean, except for maybe the Chinese.
Our looming energy independence.
Our looming, yes, whatever. Unless we sell it off and make ourselves more dependent. And the Saudis would be party to that in a heartbeat. But to prop up their economy, they require the product to be in their control. And that feeds into a lot of things you're saying. But where the Brotherhood is concerned, what is their chief difference between them? I mean, I know they're the most extreme religionists of all, and women's rights are like Afghanistan, which they have more parallel to without the control. Where are they in this whole picture?
Well, I mean, the whole thing about Saudi energy needs and these sorts of things, I mean, first off, I mean, they have the largest reserves of oil on the planet, known reserves. They have about 25% of the world's oil. The next largest country has about 10. 65% of all the oil is based in the Middle East. That's why it attracts so much attention. You know, while it's true that I think only about 3% of American oil really comes out of the Middle East, Saudi Arabia acts as a swing producer for the United States in many ways. So the idea that you could have an economic oil boycott, again, is pretty much null and void, because if Venezuela tries to initiate an oil boycott, Saudi Arabia will just produce more barrels if the United States asks them. And then the other point is, you know, something you raised that's really important. This isn't so much about us taking Middle Eastern oil for our own energy uses. It's also about not letting other potential rival powers like China, you know, get a hold of oil so that they can fuel their development. So, you know, Saudi sort of has whoever is the world superpower over a double-barreled gun in that sense, and that's why they remain very important. And you know, I would direct people to Bob Vitalis's work on the U.S.-Saudi relationship. The book's called America's Kingdom, and I mean, essentially, what he shows is that the Americans pretty much designed Saudi Arabia to look very much like Saudi Arabia, and through the oil industry. So, you know, as a matter of fact, you know, the book is called America's Kingdom, so you can see where it's going.
Yeah. On that point regarding China, what you're really inferring here is that with our connivance and control through what you just said, that we can actually pull a cord on China at any time with respect to Saudi.
Yeah, I mean, they can. Well, I mean, you know, they can't. So, I mean, there is a certain level to it, right? Saudi's going to have to sell the oil, right? So whether America's an ally of Saudi Arabia or not, I mean, they can't drink it, so they have to sell it. And they will sell it. I mean, this is why sanctions on Iran have never worked, right? Because, you know, it's great, it makes Americans feel good that we have sanctions on Iran, but nobody else does, so it really doesn't really affect their oil, selling their oil.
Well, quickly, I'm sorry, Professor Stacker, because we're running low on time. I just wanted to quickly follow up what you were saying there. If we sort of accept the premise that the ultimate goal of the Saudi royal family is to perpetuate the Saudi royal family's control, and the sale of the oil is the lifeblood of it, but what is the foreign policy of it where they are projecting their influence in all these other areas? How does that, what is the goal of that to further themselves?
Right. So, I think that the message coming out of Saudi Arabia today and, you know, since, late 2010, early 2011, is that, you know, the so-called Arab Spring or these uprisings that we've seen in all these different countries, like enough is enough. And I think that, you know, with the latest coup d'etat that we've seen in Egypt on July 3rd, I think the message has even gotten louder. The message is the Arab Spring stops now. And so they will fund whoever they need to fund to make these people go back into their homes because they don't want this going, they don't want this going on any further. And if you want to understand Saudi Arabia, all you have to do is look at that tiny country in Bahrain where the Fifth Fleet of the United States is based. When they had their uprising there, they used the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is really the sort of all those little Gulf countries. And Saudi troops actually went across the causeway and helped put down the uprising in Bahrain because they were scared that that would trickle into Saudi Arabia. And so the message really from Saudi Arabia is stop all the protesting now.
We've been speaking with Joshua Stacker. He is assistant professor at Kent State University's Department of Political Science. If you want to Google the name, the last name is spelled S-T-A-C-H-E-R, pronounced Stacker, but S-T-A-C-H-E-R. We'll link to the website merip.org as well as his Kent State website on the podcast site. Professor Stacker, anything you want to leave our audience with before we have to say goodbye?
I think that it's really important to note that, many people came out to demand a better life, more representation, better economic opportunities. They tried to do this peacefully, they tried to do this civilly, and the Egyptian military and the other militaries in the region and sort of international players have helped militarize these societies and these conflicts. And so the real depressing note for me as someone that studies this and is really committed to these places and has lived over there for a long time is that, you know, we all thought that the Mubarak regime was clumsy and stupid and, like, just stupid repressive, right? Repressive for no reason. And now what we're actually seeing is that these new regimes that are emerging are far more violent, using state violence than anything that they had under Mubarak. And that's not to say that I would love to see Hosni Mubarak come back. That's just not true. What I would like to see is I would like to see political rulers in those countries, in the countries around the world, actually listen to their populations when they say, hey, can we get a real parliament here?
The book is Adaptable Autocrats, Regime Power in Egypt and Syria. The author is Joshua Stacker. Professor Stacker, thank you for joining us this morning on The Morning Edge.
Thank you, Stacker. Appreciate it.
Anytime. It was a pleasure. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, what a scenario he sets. And it all falls back in the hands of us pulling a string with the Saudis willingly hanging on with the whole idea of maintaining the control issue and shutting the people down. Very ironic, and you know this it gives nourishment to the anti-Obamaites out there, but it and calling Obama Bush, you know, in some of these things.
Hopefully, in the months to come, we'll have Professor Stacker back again. We ran out of time. I would be curious, coming out of Kent State University and its heritage, if there's a cultural groupthink there when they watch these overseas protests.
Right.
On the other side of the break, your calls at 941-745-1490, 941-745-1490. And is a nuclear disaster coming to a Pacific Coast town where you have friends and relatives?
Let's visit that, yeah.
You're listening to The Morning Edge.
Save now, $5 a pill for Viagra or Cialis in 32-count generic packages. Compare $5 a pill to up to $25 in the U.S. Save On Meds pharmacies have been importing safe, reliable medicine to U.S. customers for 9 years. Get generic Viagra and Cialis for $5 a pill with confidence. Call for a free quote and info. It's Save On Meds, 888-6969-363, 888-6969-363.
If you have a product or a service you'd like to promote, if you have a political point of view that you would like to espouse, then we have a radio station that's right for you. WWPR AM 1490 currently has time available in half-hour blocks and 60-minute blocks. For more information, call our office line at 941-761-8843. That's 941-761-8843.
It's The Morning Edge here on WWPR, 1490 AM, heard Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 9 AM to 10 AM, and the podcast site, themorningedge.podomatic.com. That's themorningedge.podomatic.com. Had a big spike in views. I can't say a big spike in plays, but a big spike in views yesterday. I was a couple days late putting up the notices on Twitter and Facebook, and but I used a lot of hashtags in the Twitter. I don't know if that's what caused it, because we talked about the Rays and Major League Baseball.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
We talked about the Manatee High Hurricanes scandal reaching the administrators in the county school. We talked about the latest execution style murder in Manatee County that happened Thursday. So I used a lot of those keywords, and I don't know what people dropped in to find out what the heck the Morning Edge is.
Oh.
And
just to kind of get a
it was
taste
late
of it.
Last night, so I can see why people may not have bothered to listen at that time of night.
Stuck their finger in the soup and
And of course today, if I manage to get it up before my other commitments today, you know, we've got a lot of other hashtags with Egypt and Syria and Saudi Arabia, and one that I want to get to the Fukushima information here, but I do want to get a quick a comment, if we can, from you. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie plans to sign a bill Monday barring licensed therapists from trying to make gay minors straight. New Jersey will be the second state to ban the so-called conversion therapy, along with California. Bill passed both houses of the New Jersey legislature with bipartisan support. And now this would be in opposition to, of course, if parents want their child to be treated by a licensed therapist that is willing to give this so-called conversion therapy. What do you think?
Well, Because I come from a different position on the whole gay thing anyway. I believe a lot of it is sexual bonding and is more
environmental and learned behavior.
And learned, yep. I think that's where it's really at. And it's, well, when a child doesn't receive love from a parent, whichever parent is the factor, may be a factor in what bonding takes place in his life or her life. And who they get it from outside of the family or within a broader family, whatever you want to call it. And the early conditioning to love and comfort and fairness and justice and trust is a big word, is where I think love springs from. So you're going to get that, the excuse.
Okay, because I'm looking at the time, and I want to, like, set the groundwork for a future show here.
Okay.
You're going into very dangerous, not physically dangerous,
I know,
but intellectually dangerous area right now.
Okay.
Because
I'm not afraid.
Well, and the thing is, I'm ready to go right down that road with you for a change.
Oh.
Because this idea that it's one or the other, either you were born that way at birth or you were converted.
Mm-mm.
I think there is a spectrum of sexuality for the human species.
Of course.
And actually, there's, whether you go for a transgender, you can find, there's biochemistry that is evident in certain cases of sexuality. And in fact, they found changes in the brain chemistry, particularly in women, whose sexual orientation changes in their life. And so the whole doctrinaire thing is something that I'd like to explore another thing. My knee-jerk, if I can use that term, knee-jerk reaction to this law is it really is treading on parental rights when you tell your parent that you can't take your child to a therapist that's licensed in the state that says they need treatment.
Mm. Yeah, and the parent who wants the child to change...
it's probably wrong.
I would say so.
But it could be also a very confused child.
Especially under those kind of conditions, the frenzy of needing to fit in, the desire to become part of the norm. And then you hear this great movement of the gays that, well, we are the norm. We are more prevalent than you have any idea about. And I suppose there's some truth to that.
There is quite a bit of truth to that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, exactly.
But that speaks to the whole thing of there's a spectrum of sexuality.
That's right.
Of that. Yeah. And
do you want to say...
I mean, lock a bunch of men up in a prison and see what happens
to
sexuality.
Exactly.
but we said we'd get to this Fukushima thing. This is another thing we're going to have to take up more. But it's so alarming that we could at least tease this for... I don't know if we have anything planned specifically Wednesday. Maybe we'll pick it up on then.
I think.
Although
we
got to get Peter Schorsch.
We were just a minute ago, but yeah, go ahead. We're going to get Peter Schorsch on.
Well, we missed him last Friday. We're going to get him on soon.
Okay.
Emergency.
This is Tom Hartman on Russia Today.
The TEPCO, the operator of the crippled Fukushima plant, has no real plan to deal with the radioactive water leaks, and that the company's quote sense of crisis is weak. End quote. Joining me now to talk more about the situation in Fukushima is Kevin Camps, radioactive waste watchdog with Beyond Nuclear. Kevin, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. Do you agree with Japan's Nuclear Regulatory Agency that there's an emergency right now at Fukushima?
Well, the news is really bad. There seems to be an underground flood of radioactively contaminated water that's defying any constraints that Tokyo Electric is trying to put in place. And the head of the Nuclear Regulatory Authority in Japan has said that Tokyo Electric should just admit that the water will need to be released into the ocean. The fishing cooperatives in the region are up in arms about that proposal, as are other governments like China, which are downstream with the currents. So the seafood supply off of Fukushima is very much at risk at this point. This is the next big crisis at Fukushima, including the fact that they are piling up the water behind these underground walls, softening the ground, and you have three destroyed reactors and a fourth building with a very precarious high-level radioactive waste storage pool, and there are warnings by seismologists and engineers that you are softening the ground and you could cause the collapse of those buildings.
Well, in fact, if the ground is soft, you get that effect that San Francisco had during the quake of 1918 or something, where it amplifies the motion above it.
And there's ongoing earthquakes at the site.
There was just a 5.6 one some weeks ago. Let's recapitulate the history of this, because...
Okay, we're not going to recapitulate the history, but I do want to give this little bit of information about it. Even the tiniest mistake during an operation to extract 1,300 fuel rods at the crippled Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan could lead to a series of cascading failures. Not just the water that's 3,000 times more radioactive than normal that's spilling out into the Pacific.
Right now.
And this is something bigger. And the nuclear power plant in Japan could lead to a series of cascading failures with an apocalyptic outcome. And the fallout researcher, who we were just here listening to, said that TEPCO wants to extract 400 tons worth of spent fuel rods from the pool in Reactor 4.
They want to remove them.
Removal could have to be done manually from the top floor of the damaged building. Mm-hmm. A mishandled rod may go critical, resulting in an above-ground meltdown, releasing radioactive fallout with no way to stop it. And now if we go back, if we do recapitulate a little bit the history, we did have actual nuclear meltdowns in the ground of Fukushima,
right,
that leaked through the ground, that leaked into the ocean. This is open air exposure of a nuclear meltdown, worse than Chernobyl.
Yep.
Even though that did have airborne exposure. And if you look at the path that nuclear radiation after the initial Fukushima disaster was found in cows in New Jersey.
Yep.
Fish all along the Pacific coast. And this is going to make it even more exposure.
Well, this is really like a bomb going off, and it will, its effect, if people don't want to get away from nuclear plants, this is the nail in the coffin, I think, in nuclear.
And all these fuel rods that they're talking about, the possible exposure, and then when you mix them with water and the reactions that can go on if they're not maintained at certain temperatures and stability, down at Turkey Point in southeast Florida, we have over 30 years of nuclear fuel rods sitting in open tanks.
Wow.
That are stabilized until a hurricane rips through there.
Mm-hmm. Well, that will never happen.
No, what could possibly go wrong?
How could that ever happen? And remember, folks, you're only 90% water yourself, so you will find a natural emergence with this circumstance of...
Your phone won't need to light up anymore. You can do it yourself.
Just snap your fingers and you'll light up, your eyes, your hair, whatever. And it'll be the cartoon you've seen about the person lighting up from nuclear contamination. Not a joke, but it is an ironic twist on nature. And think about this. Why are so many automobiles coming from Japan? No, they're not. They're coming from the United States because Japan's getting the hell out of the business.
I do want to just stream of consciousness take up something. I didn't bring it up earlier because I didn't think we'd have time for it. We really don't now, but it is timely. Talking about better living through chemistry. Did you watch the Boston Red Sox and the New York Yankees last night?
I saw the snippet where there was a big fight.
Alex Rodriguez.
Oh, yeah. He got hit by a ball.
Of course, Boston. Booed in Boston. Big surprise there.
Now he's a hero.
It's getting to the point he's almost becoming, I might be a little stretch on my part, but it's almost sympathetic to him now because the first time at bat, the pitcher throws one that almost hits him in the foot, but he managed to get out of that one. Throws two more inside pitches to him, and then beans him up on the shoulder, way too high even for somebody like Alex Rodriguez. And that releases Joe Girardi, the manager for the
my hometown.
The Yankees, comes out. Mm-hmm. He gets thrown out. The pitcher gets thrown out. And then, of course, there's no retaliation by the Yankees. Rodriguez does come back up, knock a home run out. He went 3-for-4 that night. He's been batting over 300 since he came back. And
it's going to be very hard for Bud Selig.
And in his interviews, he's like, Eddie Haskell on Leave It to Beaver.
Oh,
I just
want
to thank all my friends. And, you know, I didn't really, even though it's obvious he was yelling stuff at the pitcher after he got hit, I really didn't say anything to him. Shucks, Mrs. Beaver.
Oh, shucks. just me hitting home runs. And then they don't like that, so they throw a ball at me.
But then you get all these baseball players. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll pass Evan Longoria because he's a relatively new player, and he's done our home team. So I won't get on him for getting on it. But all these players who had teammates that were roided up if they weren't roided up themselves, and they probably were roided up themselves, that benefited from it, that are now so outraged at what he's done to the game, and the sports talk radio guys that just go on rants about how awful
piety,
it is.
Piety, where are you? My God.
Yeah.
Just awful.
It's like, come on.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody made money on it. He just got off the bandwagon a little bit too late.
The Sosa McGuire thing was all about ratings and saving the damn game. And it was a fraud from the start. And it wasn't, and folks, even though you may believe it had to do with the steroids, it really had to do with the refs calling the strike zone in a very peculiar way. And I watched the calling of the strikes. And the strike zone, normally from the chest to the knees, was called on Sosa from the waist to the chest, where he hit his home runs, and from the waist to the ankles, where McGuire hit his. And that's where almost every home run they hit. And I watched that from that position, because I've done some umpiring in baseball myself. So this whole thing was rigged in every which way. And there's a lot of parties who got their finger in this pie.
And when you hear the old veterans talking about the 40s and 50s and Sandy Koufax and his body and stuff... Well, did you ever hear of something called Benzedrine?
Oh, Benny's, you mean?
Yeah. Okay. You know, there was a whole bunch of things they didn't test for. Just because their drugs weren't as good as today's drugs that increase your muscle mass and all, you know, it was never all that clean. And, it's a lot to pick up on another. We really hit the controversy here at the end that we got to stir the pot
it all,
later.
Yeah, exactly. No callers, though, right? You guys must be really impressed with our conversation.
Yes, they are, of course.
I think that must be it.
Huh? That's what I'm thinking all the way out to my car. We'll be back on Wednesday at 9 with another Morning Edge.
Thank you.
I was only having fun. Wasn't hurt.